You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eternal and Transient Elements, The Cosmic Past of Humanity, and The Mystery of Evil. Collected Works, Volume 184, translated by Anna Moyse. This is Lecture 4. Given on the 13th of September, 1918. I am going to continue with the theme which we have been considering for some weeks, but in a more aphoristic way. I have always told you that the great problem, when it comes to philosophies of life, is now, and I have always stressed the now, that with the views that are generally held, people find it difficult to build a bridge between the approach known as idealism and what we may call the view taken of the natural order of things. When modern people try and build such a bridge by seeking to understand how moral ideas, for instance, to take just one group from the sum of ideas, relate not outwardly but inwardly and in real terms to the views and concepts people develop on the progress of causal natural order, they end up in a kind of philosophical dualism, as we might call it from the spiritual scientific point of view. This is something we've been stressing over and over again. People try to build such a bridge, but they do not succeed. We'll find it easier to look at things relating to this question if we compare this dualism of the present day with something similar which existed in pre-Christian times. It was something which we might call fatalism. Until the second and third centuries before Christ, and later even more so, though it came to be more and more anachronistic, people were literally compelled to take a fatalistic view. Essentially, fatalism was also the basis of Greek philosophy. In more recent times, all fatalism has really been anachronistic. It is out of place in the present age. We might say that the ancients were seduced into fatalism. People of more recent times, and particularly the present, were and are seduced into dualism. Let us be clear in our minds why the ancients could so easily submit to fatalism. We know that the state of mind of human beings has changed radically in the course of evolution, and it is superstition to assume the kind of successive evolution which is assumed in common or garden variety Darwinism, for instance. The state of mind has radically changed, and history is here, more than anywhere else, a fable that has been agreed upon. The ancients' state of mind was such that they never really saw nature the way we do today. And on the other hand, things of mind and spirit were not as conceptual, based on ideas, as they are today. The idea which the ancients had of nature was that they amalgamated nature and spirit in their mind. For the spiritual, they took images from developments in nature to form their ideas. The ancient teachings of the gods were myths fully imbued with ideas taken from the natural world, perceived through the senses. Speaking of nature, the ancients would not use the dry, abstract terms we use today, but speak of elemental spirits that sustain and bring about the phenomena of nature. This was not because they expressed themselves in a very childlike way. It was because they saw things in a real way, because of a very real state of mind. People of old did not see nature the way we do now, which is under the influence of modern science, even for those of us who are not scientists. They did not see it in the abstract way, wholly in accord with ideas, in which we have to see it today. In this mingling of nature and spirit, they induced their own fatalism. For with natural phenomena, imbued with the activities of spirits, as recently described, All life was, of course, intentional in the outward way in which human actions are intentional. It was an image. But the people of old had no other image, and that inevitably led to their deceptive fatalism. A different state of mind evolved in time. We have characterized the change in the state of mind from all kinds of different angles. Today we'll look at it from a quite particular point of view. Let us consider the question which we shall, however, only be able to answer on the basis of everything which we have been considering in the last lectures. What, objectively, do people see when they follow the natural order? And what, objectively, do people think up in their minds when they speak of spirit today? I am now not saying that we speak of spirit in spiritual science. I am speaking of the way in which people in general are today speaking of spirit, with more or less of one or another nuance. We know that even those who are not theoreticians, we'll leave the theoreticians aside, will, in wanting to understand the natural order, arrive instinctively at the way in which substances and forces work. I am now not speaking of natural scientific theories of substances and forces, but of how simple the average person today quite instinctively imagines nature to be, basing his view of natural phenomena on processes which are material and rich in forces. This is where people are taken into an illusion. We know this if we look at these things, investigating them in a truly objective way. For everything that can be said about the nature of matter and forces in that case is illusion. This is not entirely due to faulty thinking, it is simply due to the present state and constitution of the mind. We are no longer speaking of Maya or illusion as people did in Indian philosophy, for instance. For in ordinary life we have no insight into the real facts. We have no insight into the real facts and are therefore really always under an illusion when visualizing nature. This is the one thing. The other is this: how do people see the spirit today? This is something which is very much adrift in abstractions. You will find this easier to see if you take one particular philosophy or another. It does not really matter at all which one you take. You can take one that offers a confusing play of words like Eucken's, or one resting on more sound foundations like Liebmann's, or you can consider one which is more to the popular taste, like Schopenhauer's, and so on. People speak of the spirit in today's philosophies. If those philosophies are not purely positivist, like Comte's, which we got to know the other day, if they are not materialistic, the philosophers will at least speak of spirit. But what do the philosophers speak of, calling it spirit, in the present state of mind? Assuming a certain substantial and force-related order, and running it like a net through the phenomena of nature, people make their view of nature into an illusion. In the same way, everything said about the spirit, from the generally accepted point of view today, is essentially an hallucination. And the accepted philosophies are really only a sum of unrecognized hallucinations. Basically, people are constituted in such a way today that in their minds they are adrift between illusion when they look at nature and hallucination when they consider the spirit. What philosophers dream about the spirit, seeking to construe a certain view of it from nothing but concepts, is really just a sum of subtle hallucinations. Subtle, yes, but nevertheless, hallucinations. These are forms that arise from the inner human being for reasons which we won't go into today, and as such do not really have anything to do with reality. I have, on quite a few occasions, drawn your attention to phenomena from the world of facts, which clearly show that all the things people may have in their minds need not have much to do with reality. To make my point, I pointed out that a whole number of philosophers are naive enough today to say that human beings must be considered to be made up of body and soul. Even the world-famous philosopher of Wundt is about body and soul, the opinion being that it is free from prejudice. But what is the whole of Wundt's philosophy? I have spoken of this before. Or what are other philosophies in general, in reality? It merely implements what was agreed on at the 8th General Council held in Constantinople in 869. That one must not, this is approximately how the definition of the resolution goes, in speaking of the human body refer to body, soul, and spirit, but that the spiritual was merely a quality of the soul principle, and it was only permissible to speak of body and soul. The trichotomy of body, soul, and spirit was considered heresy throughout the Middle Ages. Theological philosophers would quake in their boots when reality forced them even just to hint at body, soul, and spirit, for that would be heresy. Philosophers are subject to this view to this day. They merely follow the dogma established at that council in Constantinople, and they believe themselves to be free from prejudice, when in truth they are implementing a resolution by the council. We have to consider things without illusion. We must look at reality. Our young students are everywhere in philosophy, learning something that was decided on at the Council of Constantinople. Now, I certainly am not saying that the things taught today are a direct consequence or effect of that resolution. The dogma established at the 8th Council in Constantinople was in turn only thoughts expressing more profound changes that lay hidden below the surface and are still in progress today. All who want to establish dogma, be they the good philosophers at the Council of Constantinople or the good professors at today's universities, all those tissues of concepts are essentially mere conceptual hallucinations that rise up in human beings and have so little reality to them that the underlying reality cannot be truly grasped. The soul constitution of modern man is such that he is swinging to and fro, as it were, between the hallucinatory nature of his concepts and the illusory way in which he sees the natural world. He is therefore in danger of falling into dualism. He'll always be in danger of being able to take any ideas he is able to think up only into the hallucinatory sphere of concepts that do not come close to reality, or take anything he thinks up concerning nature only into the illusionary sphere of views on nature, which also has nothing to do with true reality, but is illusion. Human beings simply are not made to discover truth, as they call it, a word directly, to find it easily, I'd say. They have to start with something which in life can bring dichotomy, doubt, skepticism, and then penetrate to the truth. In the present cycle of evolution, human beings are compelled to rise from that to and fro between the hallucination of philosophy and the illusion of their view of nature to the true reality, to genuine reality. Now we might ask, I am of course speaking more or less in aphorisms, and it will need the whole to see the connection. Quote, what may we say is the most immediate reason why the people of old fell more into fatalism, and humanity of more recent times are more liable to fall into dualism when it comes to their philosophy of life. Close quote. We are in danger of this when we give ourselves up to mere play with concepts, or we might today also say mere dialectics. You will, of course, object. Quote, modern man, with its sense of reality, is not at all made to fall into mere play with concepts. Close quote. Ah, but you are quite wrong. Future ages, when our own age will be seen more objectively, will realize that such inclinations to play with mere concepts, to theorize, never existed more for humanity than they do at the present time. Today people like to escape reality, turning to mere play with concepts. But when you leave reality and start to twist and turn your concepts, to link them, separate them, the moment you have moved away from reality, you are indeed in danger of either fatalism or dualism. What matters, and what we must develop for ourselves today, is a sense of reality. I have often emphasized this from various points of view, and must do so again. It is not exactly easy to develop a sense of reality, especially also when it comes to spiritual things. It is particularly when it comes to spiritual things that we are caught up more than we think in mere play of concepts, in playful dialectics. Something which seems to be external illusion is very apt to encourage illusory notions as soon as it plays into the moral and spiritual life. People will always seek to theorize on certain things. They seek to theorize on good and evil, on freedom or necessity. When it comes to the most important questions in life, we may say, people are really dreadfully inclined to give themselves up to mere play of concepts, of words. When you come across discussions on philosophies of life, somewhere or other, it all tends to be just within conceptual dialectics. What is more, people deceive themselves by thinking that they have concepts when in reality they cannot have concepts at all. Side by side with the concepts, they also have their sympathies and antipathies for certain concepts and against others. It is according to their sympathies and antipathies that people create one or another conceptual complex for themselves. I won't go into this, however. In the great majority of discussions, which are a play on concepts, in form of questions, people do not concern themselves with reality. To be clear about what is meant here, let us take a fact often met with in life, hatred, the existence of hatred. One wants to explain such a thing as the existence of hatred in human nature. People very often try to explain this and similar things by merely playing around with concepts. Hatred exists as a mental phenomenon, a psychological reality. Yet going into these things, one soon finds that certain concepts one develops, with regard to this, do not really capture every nuance of the hatred phenomenon. We can only understand such things if we try to get from the world of illusion to the world of true reality. Hatred is something which enters into the human soul from a deeper world of reality. So one has to ask oneself, quote, this hatred, is it the same in the world of reality as it is when it presents itself in the human soul? Close quote. If it is something different in the world of reality than it is in the human soul, we shall soon realize that we, evidently, will not arrive at a spiritual view of it if we merely come to know the hatred in the human soul. If one looks for hatred in the cosmos, using the methods of spiritual science, now not in the individual human being, for hatred enters into the individual human soul. If one looks for it in the cosmos, it will be something completely different. The element which comes to realization as hatred in the human soul is also to be found out there in the cosmos. One merely must not be deceived into looking for the kind of forces of nature which the illusion in modern science is looking for. One must look into the reality that lies behind nature. There one does find the equivalent of the hatred. But in the cosmos, this hatred is something which differs greatly from what it is in the human soul. In the cosmos, hatred is a power without which individualization could never happen. There could be no separate identities, human or otherwise, if the power of hatred did not exist in the cosmos. I am not speaking of the illusion of atoms repelling one another, but of something real. Hatred does arise in the cosmos, but there it must not be judged morally the way it is when it enters into the human soul. In the cosmos, hatred is a power behind all individualization. the whole world would otherwise blur into a single whole, which is what nebulous pantheists desire. No entity would stand apart, differentiating itself, if the principle did not prevail throughout the cosmos, which human beings initially do not see in the cosmos, though it plays into the human soul, assuming the particular form which we come to know there as hatred. Now the question arises, how does humanity relate to this cosmic principle? I did already hint at this in one particular respect. Today we'll add to this in an aphoristic way. When discerning philologists, philology has also been made abstract today and has grown mediocre, but when discerning philologists studied the languages found among the Native Americans, when, in quotes, civilized people, I am putting this in quotes, had reached America and discovered the Native Americans, the more discerning philologists found that the languages of those people showed a remarkably transparent logic. There were many languages, as the philologists assure us, and as is indeed true, where the finer points of Spanish and Italian are to be found in the development and differentiation of those languages. Such things were found among the natives of Greenland. Undoubtedly, those natives did not have the intellect of which modern man is so proud. This modern intellect also would not get very far if it took up the development and creation of languages. There is plenty of evidence of what the modern intellect comes to if used to be creative in language. Objective common sense did indeed rule in human souls that were still native and had not yet developed the modern intellect. I did the other day show you how objective common sense prevailed in language creativity. The common sense which prevailed there did not yet come to human beings who were as highly individualized as today's worldly rationality is. It came to human beings who were less individualized at the time, less separate in their identity, influencing them more as cosmic rationality. In those early times, people were not the savages of whom modern anthropology creates illusory ideas. They were part of a whole organism, metaphorically speaking, of course, and came to be individualized bit by bit. They were members of a whole organism, and did still give expression to cosmic rationality, or common sense, or we might also say that cosmic rationality came to expression in them. There you have a definite indication of how the cosmic principle influences the human soul. You can also transfer it to a special phenomenon, such as cosmic hatred, which finds its way into the human soul. We know that in the spiritual sphere it will be necessary to speak of certain polarities, much as we do in the sphere of nature. How did that cosmic rationality which we have in language come about? Humanity is no longer creative where language is concerned. Only remnants of this are to be found today. How did that cosmic rationality enter into the human soul? How did it become individual? Seeking to answer this question, we come to everything we call Aramanic. How does something like the phenomenon of hatred enter into the human soul from the cosmos? There we arrive at the Luciferic principle, which is the polar opposite of the Aramanic. People feel embarrassed to speak of Ahriman and Lucifer today, but do not feel embarrassed to talk of positive or negative electricity or positive or negative magnetism. The fact that they feel embarrassed is due to a modern superstition. Even if it is clearly understood that this fact exists, that spiritual entities, things of a spiritual nature, did indeed enter on the one hand as the Luciferic principle in such elements as hatred, or as the Ahrimanic in things such as language, or also thinking, we must, on the other hand, also clearly understand the significance of things in the world at large. When my view of hatred is that I call it the basis for the great beginnings, that there can be individualization, separation, that we do not have everything in one great original stew. I am referring to the phenomenon, the fact of hatred, in the far distant past, in a past when man did not yet exist in his present form. I am referring to a very, very far distant past. I am giving you a view of hatred as it was in a far, far distant past when the human being had not yet differentiated out from the rest of the world order. We might speak of the different realms of nature, know how they developed into mineral, vegetable, animal, and human worlds. You only need to read my occult science in outline. We can speak of these natural worlds, if we do so wholly in terms of their reality and not the illusion, then the power of hatred lives in all of it, but in the way I have shown you, as cosmic hatred. There came a time in evolution when something which otherwise is general cosmic fact played into the human soul. It entered into the human soul through luciferic aromatic powers. It was then in the human soul, taken out of the cosmic as it had developed from earlier times to this day. Making a diagram of the cosmic principle from the past to the present moment as a picture, we know, having talked so much about the law of the conservation of energy or of matter, a law which in fact does not exist, that anything which is real in a purely natural way in the present, including matter, will come to an end. We know that anything which today has a here and now, that can only be seen in the spirit, is the seed also for future matter or substance. Taking the spiritual view, we have to say that everything which is now order of the past has flowed from the spiritual. Everything which has thus flowed out will come to an end. The order of the future will only flow from the spiritual henceforth. It could never become fixed natural order if there were such a thing as conservation of energy and of matter. The most powerful of all superstitions ever to have existed is that there is conservation of matter and of energy. The spiritual, which today makes itself known only in thoughts, is the seed for the natural order of the future, just as the small seed of a plant, which only makes itself known in a small way, in the present year's plant, will be the plant of the following year. This means that man himself fits into the world order in a conflicting way. Our attention is drawn to man in this conflict when we seek to understand the whole situation. When, above all, we want to find the transition from cosmic hatred to the hatred in the individual soul, the hatred which shows itself in human nature. As you know, when we look at a human being before us, we are able to say, forming ideas, feeling, and acting out of the will, that is his nature. He shows himself to us to have idea-forming, feeling, and will-based nature, and these make up a whole. But all the beautiful things said about this in philosophy will not get us anywhere, unless we are also able to make clear and accurate distinctions. Even the sharp-witted psychologists of our time are beginning to realize that we don't really know anything much about acting out of the will. I've explained to you how we act out of the will. For today, it is enough to indicate that present-day psychologists also have to say to themselves that we don't know much, really, about acting out of the will. Even when awake, human beings really sleep through the way they act out of the will, such being its essential nature. We might also say that human beings do not reach down as far with their souls as acting out of the will. They believe, I spoke of this as a concrete fact when discussing Augustine, that they are right within their essential nature when they form ideas. It is not something they can say, however, when it comes to acting out of the will. In waking life, people know as little about the way in which some intention connects with even just the complicated mechanism of a hand movement or of the legs walking, as they know about their living body or their environment when they sleep. Acting out of the will is something we sleep through at the present time. When we use the methods of spiritual science and penetrate from mere idea to action, we learn from the facts, though these are spiritual facts, how it happens that human beings sleep through the way they act out of the will today. We'd really be in a very bad way with our thinking, our intellect, if it were not for the other circumstance which I have mentioned, and which I'll shortly consider in more detail. We'd really be in a very bad way with our thinking, for basically, it is always childlike where our essential human nature is concerned. In the course of life, between birth and death, our thinking gains some knowledge about the immediate present in the world. Nothing about past and future, or at most some hypotheses, though these do immediately fall apart if one gets really serious about them. This thinking is indeed the seed for the future. Just as a plant seed is something which does not really have much significance today, but will at best have next year, so does our thinking today have no value in real terms. It relates to what could be in real value the way a child does to an adult. Read that again. It relates to what it could be in real value the way a child does to an adult. Thinking is really wholly made for the future, but only what is going to become of it will have real significance in future. The actual content, the substance of thinking, only has seed value today. However, if we use spiritual science to enter into will-based action, seeking to perceive the subject of it, it is just an activity, but seeking to perceive the subject of our own will-based action, it will be something which bears within it awareness of the most far distant past, of the cosmic past. You will never understand world evolution using only the intellect, unless you enter into will-based action with vision in images, inspiration, and intuition. It is only in the human will to act, which at the same time builds up the whole human organism, that we find a subject which holds the memory of the cosmic past, just as you have memory of your ordinary life. The difference between the human intellect and the human will to act is that the human intellect will, at best, only develop a memory for one's individual, personal life. The will to act, out of the reach of the human intellect, holds the memory of the cosmic past. Human beings bear the memory of the cosmic past in them, but without spiritual scientific investigation, they cannot reach it with their intellect. We may say, therefore, that on the one hand, human beings have the will to act as a faculty, bearing within them, figuratively speaking, the memory of the cosmic past. As intelligent beings, they bear within them only the present, for the intellect is but seed for the future and not yet present for the present. And not yet something for the present. Read that again. As intelligent beings, they bear within them only the present, for the intellect is but seed for the future and not yet something for the present. With reference to the will to act, the human intellect is just like the tiny seed in relation to the whole plant. Having the will to act faculty, we are, as cosmic spirits, based on the whole of the past, because we are individuals. As intelligent human beings, we are in the present, and we prepare to grow into the future. Our will-to-act faculty may thus truly be said to relate to the intellect the way a very old person does to a child. The human being with the will to act relates to the thinking human being the way a very old person does to a child, with the necessary extension of time, of course. What can balance this out? Cosmic common sense, which I have earlier and on many occasions called the Ahrimanic principle, influences the thinking human being. If we had to depend on ourselves as human beings, without Ahriman's influence, the situation for our intellect would be very different at the present time. The Roman Catholic Church might be highly satisfied with a humanity that had only the measure of the intellect which today arises from human nature itself. relative to the potential which man has in the whole cosmos, this intellect is childlike, just as our will to act is very old indeed. The Ahrimanic principle influences our thinking, and our thinking cannot be thought of in evolution without the involvement of the element of speech, for instance. The Luciferic principle influences our will to act. The Ahrimanic principle penetrates us by winding our intellect, which in evolution as a whole is still relatively weak and childlike, up higher and higher to a certain sun height. But there is also the other side of the coin. We have an intellect which is not really arising from us. We have an intellect which we might roughly compare not to a plant which rises from the ground and then has the seed, but to a plant which has another plant set upon it, which does not bear seed but is another plant, another more perfect plant. Our intellect is arranged, organized, Ahrimanically. Because of this, it tends to blind us. As spiritual scientists, we do not, of course, say that we should not use this intellect, seeing that it is Ahrimanic. It is merely that one must look at things without illusion, be clear that the human intellect is a powerful light, and may shine even more strongly than the intellect which is coming forth from human nature today is able to do. The intellectual principle can deceive human nature, placing things into a certain sphere for them where they are dazzled. When human beings use their intellect to cast light on this, it is like a blinding light. And it is really because of this that human beings make things into illusion. Just as the Ahrimanic principle influences the intellect, so does the Luciferic principle influence our will to act, so that it goes to sleep. Really goes to sleep. The Ahrimanic principle enlightens our seed-like intellect. The Luciferic principle lulls, puts to sleep our will to act, subject which really bears the memory of the whole past in it, with the result that people know nothing of that past. This, taken at a somewhat deeper level, is the basis for dualism in man. The dualism must be bridged, but cannot be bridged if we turn merely to theories. We have to turn to the facts themselves, the facts of spiritual life, knowing that our intellect has a different prime origin in the world than our will to act. The situation with them is like having a child and a very old person standing side by side. We would be artificially deceiving ourselves in setting up the abstract notion, in quotes, man, which really is nothing but an abstraction, and in saying, quote, the child is a human being, and the very old person is a human being, close quote. Such concepts suit people today, because they mix everything up. Thus the soul is said to be uniform today, thinking that as such it has the same prime origin as intellectual thinking and a loving will to act. But, as I have just been indicating, we must make distinctions if we really want to understand the human being. The philosophy of life we think up, using only the intellect, will therefore never get anywhere near reality. It remains hallucination, for it arises from an intellect filled with a spirit that is not of this world, with the Ahrimanic spirit which does not belong in the world order, which we behold with our eyes. The same holds true in its own way for the will to act, for this is filled with Luciferic spirit. People have always had a feeling for this, or given expression to it. Hardly anyone realizes, for instance, that in the Old Testament there is already some idea at least of this polar opposition of Ahrimanic and Luciferic. I am saying it is not much realized, because people will nicely read chapter after chapter in the Bible and there too make no distinction. No distinction is made between the book of Job and the Pentateuch, five books of Moses. Yet the distinction between those books does give a first idea of the polar opposition between Aramaic and Luciferic, which we need to grasp. Moses poses the question as to the evil in human nature. That is, if I may put it like this, how cosmic hatred, human hatred, influences human beings. Moses inquires into evil. He then presents the fall in a magnificent picture. We know that hidden behind the fall is the entry of the Luciferic principle into human nature. Then a certain consequence is connected with Moses' view that really all misfortune and even death is due to this human sin, or pre-human sin, if you prefer. We may say, therefore, that misfortune and death are the consequence of sin. The book of Job presents the radically opposite view. In the first place, you do not have a serpent, but a purely spiritual entity, an Aramaic spirit approaching the divine spirit. And in Job, we do not have someone like Adam, who is capable of falling into sin, but indeed someone who is said to be, quote, perfect and upright, close quote. How does that spirit, who approaches God, want to achieve his aim of having Job fall into sin by bringing misfortune upon him? It is exactly the opposite. This spirit wants to bring misfortune on Job so that he will fall into sin. The misfortune has come, and misfortune is said to lead to sin. According to Moses, misfortune comes from sin. In the book of Job, sin comes from misfortune. Views are in radical opposition in the more pagan book of Job and the Jewish book of Moses. But, as I said, people read one thing after the other and do not pay attention. Today it is absolutely necessary that people are not misguided into the idiotic self-knowledge, in quotes, which is so often said to be desirable, but that they truly come to know themselves and objectively know how to distinguish between intellect and will, just as they learn to distinguish between hydrogen and oxygen. Otherwise, they will only apparently overcome a certain dualism. Things that happen in one period of time have always been long in preparation, and we can really only study the things that stand out as being particularly significant in an era. Wanting to be thorough in building a bridge in the present-day dualism, let us, above all, consider on the one hand the hallucinatory nature of the intellect, which is connected with everything of which I have been speaking, and, on the other hand, the illusory nature of natural phenomena, which I have also been discussing. These take human beings into a kind of inner conflict in life. Two streams are active in them, and they must aim to let there be only one. One stream is particularly seductive. It is the stream which arises from the relationship which people have in their souls with the natural order. A person of our time who sees reality for all things to be of the same kind, an anatomist, to take an obvious example, or a physiologist, will take the human body today and distinguish only outwardly, not inwardly, between the individual members of this body. I'd say he puts the heart beside the liver, and investigates both organs only externally, not taking account of the time perspective of which I spoke the other day. In fact, we will only learn properly about the nature of the heart and of the liver if we proceed in a genuinely spiritual scientific way in embryology, learning to distinguish in time the beginnings of the heart in early embryology. We also cannot simply put them side by side and say they consist of cells. On the one hand, this is correct, and on the other, it is nonsense. We know very well that something can be correct and a nonsense at one and the same time. However, in the scientific stream, efforts are made today to explain the natural order, taking no account of things being at different times, but putting them side by side, and this leads to abstraction. Then the temptation is particularly great to put things side by side, cause, effect, abstract, illusory, causal order. We know from things I told you last year, and also this year, that this is not the way to look at nature, that nature only becomes explicable if one looks at it in the first place as reflecting something which is spiritual. Then you arrive at the true theory of metamorphosis, at genuine Goetheanism. Then the human head is seen as something which reflects an infinitely distant past, and the organism of extremities as something which points to a distant future. There, something which exists on its own is seen not merely in a causal chain, but as imagination, the image of something which is behind it. We will not understand the human head if we merely look at it as growing out of the rest of the human organism. In reality, it has been created out of the whole cosmos, and in a different way from the way in which the organism of extremities is created, for instance. In physics, everyone would think it ridiculous if one were to explain that the compass needle always points north because there is a force inside it that makes it point north. No, one realizes that there is one pole and the other pole because the cosmos, Earth's magnetism, gives the compass needle its direction. Yet when it comes to man or to any organism, they say everything grows from it in a straight line. Just as the compass needle points north on one side and south on the other, for cosmic reasons, so does the human head point back to an infinitely far, distant past, and indeed into past times when the earth had metamorphosed itself, and the organism of extremities points to far distant futures, for temporal cosmic reasons. The orientation is cosmic, and it is in time. This will be the ultimate development of genuine Goetheanism, rising from mere illusory causal order to seeing nature through vision in images, recognizing that what we have before us is the image of something else, we rise above mere illusion. But we must not stop at nature. We need a correlate, something to complement it. Someone who talks about nature in that way would again be a fantasist if he were to take nature in that way and not, on the other hand, declare, quote, "Such spirit, as is said to be the opposite of nature, in more recent philosophies, is also hallucination, and again we must not stop at this." Close quote. All that lives today has developed slowly, and humanity has gone through all kinds of different stages, gradually advancing, I'd say, to the point where the human soul is in the process of gaining insight into the spirit. We can distinguish three stages in this. Just as we can say that our understanding of nature is still very confused today, and strive toward the stages of insight, which in my knowledge of the higher worlds are called imagination, inspiration, and intuition, so we can say that the human soul principle has gradually developed intellectually through three stages of being truly within the spirit, so as to truly grasp things in mind and spirit. These are the three stages: living with an idea of the spirit, which is of course something hallucinatory, because one takes the spirit as it is at the present time, and does not realize that it is seed for the future. Living with the idea, dreamlike, having some idea of the spirit. The second stage is prophetic vision, where something of the future is truly experienced in visions, like those of the ancient Hebrew prophets. And something does already live in there of knowing that the mind and spirit has the quality of being seed for the future. The third stage, little understood as yet, but there is a depth to it, involves taking an apocalyptic view of the world. All of these stages are preliminary to gaining the spiritual scientific view, though this must, on the other hand, combine with the vision of nature in images. Otherwise it would, metaphorically speaking, float in the air. Seeing nature in images raises us beyond the illusory aspect of natural science, a realistic attitude to the process which goes through having an idea, an inkling of the future, vision of the future, prophetic vision, apocalyptic vision, raises us above the hallucinatory element in the life of mind and spirit. We absolutely must not take the spirit the way it is taken in more recent philosophies. That is the human mission in the present time. We must not take nature the way it is taken in the naive view of nature, nor in the theoretical natural science of today. No, we must lay aside the illusions we have about nature, as it were, and perceive the way in which it is but an image of something else. And we have to realize that the mind and spirit is mere shadow image in the way in which it presents itself in modern philosophy. Then a bridge is built between the ordinary way of seeing mind and spirit and the ordinary way of seeing nature. And there will be a third thing. Mere discussion has never served to overcome such things as dualism, only looking at the facts. But it must be all the facts, and then finding a third element to go with the two. The symbol used must therefore represent a trinity. We do, of course, understand today that these concepts again refer to something which floats on top. But we have to have concepts. They do no harm so long as we do not overestimate them. We are speaking of normal humanity, of the Luciferic and the Ahrimanic principles, and also making a representation of this. It is to be the central focus of our building. Auguste Comte also had an inkling that there had to be a view that was threefold by nature. He spoke of the Trinity to which I referred the other day. This genuine Trinity, which will encompass the view of mind and spirit and the view of nature and thus truly overcome dualism, must also have the spiritual science with anthroposophic orientation within it. One cannot therefore arrive at a genuine anthroposophic spiritual science unless one also gives serious consideration to the light and shadow sides of present-day natural science and science of mind and spirit. These things have to be taken seriously. Merely throwing things together and establishing theories will not achieve anything considering the seriousness of the present-day situation. Life does not proceed in a general mix, but is differentiated and individualized. Anything striven for in future must be striven for in a differentiated way from the beginning. It is still widely the bad habit today to treat everything the same way. When someone has a political theory today, he will also shape everything else according to that political theory. Philosophies of life and so on, treating everything the same, all based on his favorite theory. That is how it is in our day. Life proceeds in a differentiated way. Only someone who knows this will be free from illusion. The future lies not in striving for a general mix of life, but for marked differentiation, for a life in mind and spirit as true knowledge, a certain inner life, of which people have little idea as yet. A life which, in the thinking of earlier times, may be called a religious life, and for political life. Throwing everything together, regulating one thing the way one does another, one falls into the kind of error of which I spoke last year, or indeed 2 years ago. Things run in separate streams. On one side, social life, according to socialism. On the other, religious life, according to freedom of thought, and scientific life according to pneumatology, the study of spiritual entities and phenomena and the nature of the human spirit. The three must work together in a living way if the future is to offer a certain healing power in human evolution. Not a paradise on earth, there being no such thing, but a certain healing power. It would be anything but good, however, if people were to think of external life in pneumatological terms, for instance, establish religious sects and fill them with pneumatological life, that is, run political life from the pneumatological point of view. That would bring nothing, nor would it bring anything if religious communities were to do politics in the old sense. just as the hands cannot do the things the head is able to do, nor the legs. So pneumatology cannot do what socialism should be doing, nor religion what socialism should be doing, or indeed pneumatology. What matters is differentiation of certain things, but not just in theory but in actual life. I want to conclude with this today, taking it further tomorrow. As I said, it is meant to be merely aphoristic, adding some new aspects to the basic issues with which we are concerned. That is the end of the lecture, Lecture 4, but there is an addendum, and I'm going to read that. It's at the end of the book in note number 29. Editor's comment, first of all. At the end of the lecture, Rudolf Steiner added the following comments relating to disagreements among some of the members. See also the volume now in preparation on Anthroposophy and its opponents, German titled Die Anthroposophie und ihre Gegner, CW 255b. These were not included in earlier editions of this volume, and now the notes by Steiner, the additional notes. In addition, I wish to say the following. I am under no illusion. You know, or at least some who do truly understand some of the things I put forward should know, I am not inclined toward persecution mania, nor to any kind of illusions in life. Genuine spiritual science does thoroughly rid one of such things. In spite of this, I do sometimes have to comment on one thing or another. It is sometimes necessary to make such a comment so that members who call themselves anthroposophic do not completely go to sleep. I do not want people to be under any illusion. Well, there are a number of things that need to be said. However, because of a particular recent incident, I want to say the following. It is true that in the immediate future, this movement, which I call anthroposophic, will be exposed to major attacks from various angles, and particularly from one side, which is already very evident. Individual attacks are of very little account, for whatever people say individually is usually as amateurish as can be. But the fact remains that it has been an attack, especially when coming from the clerical side as of now. There is an intention behind this, and that is more important than what is said in individual instances and must be taken very seriously. With regard to something which happened just the other day, I therefore wish to say the following. The kind of thing I mean here must, of course, be taken as such in human life that one does not pay further attention to it the way it comes to me. Those concerned will know what this is about. Anyone who wishes to tell me something or discuss something with me should do so quite openly, nor should they imagine that they have something to bring that is essential if they are not speaking openly. As I said, I am under no illusion, and anyone who thinks that I am under some illusion is very much in error. Even if it should be the case that there are people here, on the building site, who bear things on two shoulders, as the saying goes, given up to some ambiguity, there is no need to try and inform me about this in some covert way. I know more about people, including those who walk around on our building site, than I am able to tell, things I must have in mind. No one should think that it is necessary to draw my attention to it in a covert way, that harmful things may perhaps be happening here. For in the way in which social life has to be, when one is having an eye on something as real as this building project, it is not always possible to act according to genuine insight, gained from deeper background knowledge. Anyone who does, after all, want to tell me something should do so openly. Otherwise, people will be under the illusion that I am deluded and had illusions about the people with whom I have to deal. I do not do so. I know that people can also be two-faced. And that is the end of the end comments, and let's say the complete end of Lecture 4.